Standard Issue for all women.
Hello and welcome to episode 175 of the Standard Issue Podzine. I'm Mickey Noonan and I'd really like my light evenings back, please.
Yeah, it's horrible. I don't like it.
I have to say, from a parenting perspective, it's actually quite useful.
More sleepy times.
That's the idea, yes. I feel like everyone has like a really vivid memory of being a child and being told they have to go to bed, but being aware of the sun sort of behind the curtains and the noises of people playing outside and laughing and drinking wine in the garden and stuff.
Yeah.
It's not helpful for getting children to bed, basically, is what I'm saying.
It's FOMO before FOMO was actually coined as a FOMO.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
I'm Hannah Dunleavy, and I don't like any clothes for little girls.
I will second that.
I say this, Jen, because we're going to see you later in the week. So since I was in town, I thought I'll buy Lyra something. And three shops and an hour and a half later, I thought, I'll just give her some money. I hate them all.
I've now got a vision of on Friday, Hannah just passing Lyra a couple of notes and going, treat yourself.
She mostly wears things with animals on. That's what I'm going for. And I do buy her quite a lot of boys' stuff, and people do quite often think that she is a boy.
I have no problem with, like, because, again, I don't really think there's such a thing as boys' clothes and girls' clothes, but quite a lot of them actually have the word boy actually on them. A lot of them were literally gendered with words, if that
Why?
Makes sense.
Because we need to start them early, Jen.
Do you know what I hate? And I don't want to offend anyone who likes this stuff, because obviously we're all different. We all have different sartorial choices, etc. I fucking hate a headband on a baby girl, like one with a flower on it or a bow or whatever, because I think the only purpose of that is to gender the child. The only purpose of it is to be like, this is a girl. And I don't like it, because they haven't got any fucking hair. They don't need it, not in their way. They
Your baby's got loads of hair.
She has got loads of hair, but it stands up. It doesn't hang down in her face. So
I think it's because of the babies that don't have loads of hair.
Yeah.
They just like, yeah. we need something interesting up here. Also, for any like 2-year-old, 3-year-old boys listening, if you want to wear a headband, crack on, mate.
Totally fair enough.
I know lots of people like them, and each their own. Anyway, I'm Jen Offord, and my daughter has learnt to give kisses.
Aww.
And I think this is why people bother to have children.
I think she's practicing because she's going to see me.
Probably.
That's what it is. I've been practicing too, Hannah. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, great. As long as you don't grab my tits with such abandon as most children do, that'll be fine.
Fucking spoil sport. Every time I'm excited about something, you just slap me down.
Most children tend to use it just as, especially if you're holding them on the side, tend to use it just as a resting place for their other hand.
So I'm just sensible, though, to be fair.
Practical children.
Yeah.
Later on, I catch up with the crisp hoovering, a dinosaur-loving delight that is Daisy Haggard. Oh yeah, she's also the creator, writer and star of the brilliant Back to Life.
Yay!
Hooray! I speak to playwright and director Catherine Cranfield about premature ovarian insufficiency and her play Flushed.
I feel like a cheer would be out of place here, but I also don't want Catherine to feel left out of the excitement.
She was lovely. Yeah.
In Jenny of the Blocks, I'll be talking about a new report into why girls are put off sport and the same old headline news, in inverted commas.
And in Rated or Dated, I'm reassessing where I fall on the scale of female toughness as we watch 1976's Harlan County, USA.
I mean, is it so bad for women to be in the home? That's all I'll say after watching that film. But first, Her Maj's favourite, obviously, the gender problem with tiny plastic bricks and the risky business of not wanting kids. It's time for the Bush Telegraph. Cue Sting.
Bush Telegraph.
Welcome to the Bush Telegraph, where we are still reeling from the news that John Lennon split up the Beatles.
I always thought it was Ringo.
Well, I mean, who wouldn't on the basis of those videos, huh?
Peace and love.
Peace and love, my eye.
How is this news?
Well, exactly. This is the thing. Haven't we known this for, like, I don't know, the best part of 50 years?
I'm going to say, yeah. But Paul's got a... Paul, because we're mates. Paul McCartney's got a book coming out for Christmas, hasn't he? So it might just be that he's mentioned it in an interview and then people have just pulled that out and gone, oh, that's exciting. And it's like, is it? I heard it was all Yoko Ono's fault, obviously.
Well, yeah, obviously that as well. I thought it was like pretty much not being questioned who'd split up the Beatles.
I mean, what if Paul's lying? John can't defend himself now.
True, he's dead. Breaking news. You might remember that last week we chatted about at least, in inverted commas, 15 serving or former police officers, male, ofs, or if you prefer, baddens, to have killed women in the UK since 2009. It is a grim statistic, which was revealed in the wake of the sentencing of former Metropolitan Police Officer Wayne Cousins, who was serving when he kidnapped, raped and murdered Sarah Everard. Have you got room for more grimness?
I feel like it's a rhetorical question, Jen, because actually I want to scream at the sky, no, I have been full for ages, but carry on.
Sorry, mate, it's going to happen. So how about 750 allegations of sexual misconduct made against serving police officers across 31 different forces in England, Wales and Scotland between 2016 and 2020?
That's fun, isn't it? It's fun.
It's quite a lot, isn't it?
It's a lot.
Yeah, most complaints were a Kel surprise against male officers, although the data did not show whether the cases were historical or if the police officers were on duty at the time. But I'm going to throw it out there and say it's still bad, isn't it?
It is still very, very bad.
So of those 750 allegations, at least, there is again, in inverted commas, 34 cases resulted in dismissal.
I mean, seriously, if the number is as low as 34, that at least is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
It is. That is less than, I mean, my maths is really crap, but that is less than 5%, isn't it? It is significantly better, however, than the current conviction rate for rape.
I don't think you're telling me that to cheer me up, Jen.
Sorry, Mick, I'm not, no. So while we're on the subject of sexual assault, and indeed the Metropolitan Police, what's going on with clinically unsweaty, dough-ball aficionado Prince Andrew, I hear you ask?
That is an excellent description of him.
You're welcome. Well, the answer to that is absolutely nothing, or at least in this country, anyway. Over in the US, the Duke of York is being sued by 38-year-old Virginia Giuffre, who alleges that he sexually assaulted her as a teenager. She alleges that the assaults took place a number of times across different locations, including on convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's private Caribbean island. Prince Andrew has consistently denied these allegations. He can't sweat, remember, so it couldn't possibly have happened. Anyway, having undertaken a review into a previous decision not to investigate allegations made against Jeffrey Epstein and his former girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell, those allegations being that they trafficked, groomed and abused women and girls in the UK, the force also reviewed whether any further action be taken against Prince Andrew. Mick, guess what they decided?
Oh, go on, Jen, fill me with glee. Is he going down?
They are not going to take any further action. Can you believe it?
Oh, I'd love to say I am agog, but I know. No, I'm not. I'm not agog at all. I do absolutely believe it. The Met, once again, champions of women.
Yeah, it's shit, isn't it? I don't know what else to say. It's really shit.
Sometimes, listeners, I think you need to understand how hard it is for us to just not write, oh, this happened, shit, innit? Because
bollocks.
Basically our general feelings about things. Now then, I say that, but I come bearing the good news that a company is going backwards in its values.
Oh.
Bear with me. Lego, maker of tiny plastic bricks for children / bringers of excruciating foot pain for adults, has announced it will work to remove gender stereotypes from its toys. Well, hooray, hooray, and once more hooray for that. Let toys be toys should be the only policy around playthings for kids, as far as I'm concerned. And indeed, as far as past Lego was concerned too. Catalogues from the 1950s to the 1980s show universal building sets with simple cooperative play for boys, girls, and indeed in one campaign, a whole multi-generational family. Tiny plastic bricks for everyone! A much-lauded Lego ad from 1981 that shows a beaming little red-headed lass proudly holding up her Lego creation with the tagline, "What it is beautiful." To be fair, the 70s did see the Danish toy maker introduce specifically gendered Lego, such as the Homemaker range, very clearly marketed at girls. But in the main, basic sets continued to be for boys and girls alike, with boys and girls playing together in the adverts. And so that recent Lego announcement is actually a recognition that since then, the company's gender politics have become a bit regressive, really, divided neatly into separate colour-coded boy and girl aisles in the shops, because tiny plastic bricks clearly have a gender identity, for fuck's sake. I'm shaking my head. You can't see it. I think you can hear it. So, why the backwards but actually forwards move, Lego? Well, it turns out attitudes to play and future careers remain unequal and restrictive. Jen, as a woman, had you any idea of this?
No way. No,
I thought you'd be surprised. It seems, however, that while girls are becoming more confident and up for a wide range of activities, which is clearly great news, boys are worried they'd be made fun of if they played with what they described as girls' toys. And not an insignificant amount of boys either. In a global survey of almost 7,000 parents and of children aged 6 to 14 commissioned by Lego, 71% of the boys had this fear. What's more, quote, parents are more worried that their sons will be teased than their daughters for playing with toys associated with the other gender. So said Madeline DeNonno, the chief executive of the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media, yep, that Gina Davis, who conducted the research. And while I'd really like to tell those parents to get a fucking grip and pass it on to their sons, that fear doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from, and absolutely no prizes for guessing correctly, ingrained sexism and gender stereotyping. Because, DeNonno continues, behaviours associated with men are valued more highly in society. Until societies recognise that behaviours and activities typically associated with women are as valuable or important, parents and children will be tentative to embrace them. We're working hard to make Lego more inclusive, added Julia Golden, the Chief Product and Marketing Officer at the Lego Group. And if you check the Lego website, you will know it no longer labels any of its products for girls or for boys. You can't search for products by gender. And instead, it offers what it calls passion points. Disney, Harry Potter, Jurassic World, Frozen, Star Wars, etc., etc. So, yeah, well done, Lego, for working hard to undo all that hard work you put into making tiny plastic bricks exclusive in the first place.
Yeah. I do kind of get that point about parents being worried that children will be teased, because obviously you don't want your children to be teased. So it might not even be you that has the attitude. It might be the fear of other people's attitudes, right? Because you are only one influence on their lives. There's so much more going on in the world, and I guess it's all very well being like, well, you can raise them to think this, that, or whatever, or like instill values in them, etc., but you are just one part of their world. So I do kind of get that, but what I would say is that, like, also girls' toys are shit compared to boys' toys. I was in TK Maxx in the hinterland bit of TK Maxx away from the clothes, and I saw one of the toys there was like, I can't remember who it's, maybe it was Barbie branded, that would be about right, wouldn't it? But I can't remember who it's branded by, but it's like a toy iron. Who wants to fucking play with that? Like, I don't want to do ironing in real life, like, let alone it be like some kind of fantasy make-believe thing. Like, I haven't ironed anything for about, I'd say, 15 years.
I'd like to say that obviously you have to learn somehow, and kids' toys, when it's that kind of active stuff, it is teaching seriously not only girls how to iron but boys how to iron, etc., etc. But also ironing is a really bad example, because exactly the same as you, I'm pretty sure the last time I ironed something I was already wearing it, and I just thought, I can't leave the house like this. It was a moment of desperation. But yeah, I think there certain toys are so that you learn some skills for your life.
But that toy was pink.
I bet it was.
Like, all of the packaging was pink, blah, blah, blah. It was clearly marketed at girls. So, yeah, no, you're right. And that hadn't actually occurred to me. You do have a point there, but it was clearly marketed at girls. And the hilarious thing is, most women's clothing doesn't fucking need ironing. Whose clothing needs ironing? It's men's bloody shirts, isn't it?
And school uniforms, I guess. Again, though, just take my mum's approach, and she was a firm believer in hanging while damp.
Well done, Anne. That's an approach I intend to take myself. Get it in the room with the shower, lovely stuff. Let the steam do its work.
She clearly wasn't bothered about me being teased about that, was she?
So much teasing, kids are cruel. Mick, would you like some good news?
Yes, please.
How about the unveiling of a new statue of not just a woman, but a bloody brilliant one at that?
Don't be silly, Jen, they don't exist.
Well, Mick, Baroness Barbara Castle, the youngest woman to be elected in a landslide victory for Labour in 1945, has been honoured with a bronze statue in Jubilee Square, Blackburn, where she served as an MP for 34 years.
Obviously, I was only joking. Loads of excellent women exist, and that is a bona fide Bobby Dazzler.
I like to think anyone listening to this podcast knows that you think lots of women are excellent, but fair play. The statue by Sam Holland shows Baroness Castle, former Employment and Transport Minister, mid-stride, holding the Equal Pay Act, and it doesn't even look utterly ridiculous.
Does it actually look like her?
It does. The Equal Pay Act was, of course, an act for which she was responsible, and she was also responsible for mothers receiving child benefit directly, which is obviously an excellent policy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so she was outspoken, radical and feisty as fuck. And I would like to quote Babs now in a message I think our current leaders could take something from. In politics, guts is all.
More news next week.
Well, you have equal pay, but, you know, they're not equal, are they?
Sexism of the week. It's that time of the week where I think long and hard. Did I really consider whether I wanted children? Like really? And you know, yes I did. I don't know a woman who hasn't thought about it, even if her reaction is to shudder and then laugh for like an hour. Would my mind have been changed though if, say, my university had told me that unless I got on board the family train by my 30s, I risked childlessness? Well, that's where I shudder then laugh for an hour. Still, this is exactly what women at Cambridge University's Murray Edwards College, one of its last single-sex colleges, are being taught. In an article in The Times, 69-year-old Dorothy Byrne, the new president of Murray Edwards, said she was not scaremongering but wanted to, quote, empower female students, adding that fertility had become a, quote, forbidden subject and many women risked leaving it too late. Byrne, in case you're wondering, had her only daughter as a single parent at, checks notes, age 45. Oh. The Times also spoke to Lisa Burke, an alumna of Murray Edwards. Burke welcomed the development, telling the paper, "I had my children young. I was 29 with my first and had just turned 33 with my second. I was the first of my peer group to have children. At the time, I would say it destroyed my career. It's taken me a lot of time to rebuild my work." Oh, again. Now, I am not slagging off either of these women who chose to have families when they wanted to, because that is as it should be, and key this, it's none of my fucking business. A woman's womb is her own affair, and it is patronising and offensive to suggest that women aren't aware of their own biological clocks, be that like hormones or their body or their brains or emotions, however that manifests. On which note, the idea that she might risk, in inverted commas, childlessness. I mean, all credit to my many mates who are mummers and doing their little ones proud. But for many women I know, being child-free is a choice rather than, oh, they've wound up because they didn't do their homework. Also, quick question. Who's having conversations with boys and young men about planning a family and what it means for their career? When do they risk missing out on kids? I mean, I assume that's happening, right? Otherwise, if those conversations aren't happening, it feels like the very act of caring is gendered, in that the responsibility of family is, same as it ever was, pushed onto girls and women.
Yep. I spoke to Nell Frizzell about this. She writes about it in her book, The Panic Years. Exactly that. All of that. What a load of absolute fucking bollocks. The research that we have is outdated. Everyone knows that it's outdated. Everyone knows that it's based on the research of monks in like 18th century France. Everyone fucking knows that. So why are we still peddling this bullshit? I think like it's absolutely fair to teach men and women about like the scientific limitations of their bodies. Yes, of course.
Be armed with knowledge. Absolutely.
Absolutely. But when it's not being done both ways, when it's all on the women, when it's all based on like fucking bullshit that's designed to like repress women as well, like it makes me very angry.
Also, at university, would you even listen? Right?
No, of course you wouldn't. It would feel so alien, wouldn't it, to be like 20 years old and someone telling you about a decision you're going to have to make in like 15 years' time.
It feels like that university would then feel like a finishing school. If you're like, yeah, well, if I'm going to have to at some point, at the very least, halt my career, what is this for?
Funny you should say that, Mick, because listeners, I don't want to like ruin the magic for you here, but we talk about like what stories we're going to talk about on the British Telegraph before we do it. And from the headline, I was a bit like, what is this shit? Is this like where they get women to walk with books on their heads and crap like that?
Yeah. As the very wise journalist Gabby Hinsliff said on the Twitter about whether she'd have listened at university, no. She said things that might have made a difference include novelties like not seeing female colleagues get fired for getting pregnant while in my 20s. And maybe for young women now, being able to actually buy a house before you're 40. Probably quite relevant. Hello, I'm joined on the Zoom by Daisy Haggard, writer, actor and creator of the glorious Back to Life. Daisy, hello.
Hello.
So last time we met, you and I were on stage doing a crisp off, cutting our mouths to shreds with Walker's salt and vinegar. So one, sorry. Two, yeah. How's your mouth?
It was really sore, wasn't it? It was quite stingy.
It was pretty sore. But you're a big crisp fan, so I wondered what your current crisp recommendation is.
So I like to mix a bowl. I like a bowl, a big mixture. And currently, I think I have so many crisps in my cupboard at all times. But I think I went for Beef Monster Munch, Hula Hoops, and salt and vinegar square combination in a bowl recently. That was the last one.
That is a good collection of retro snacks.
It's strong.
They didn't make you do any sort of crisp eating on Graham Norton the other night. Very disappointing.
I know. I know. They let me off the hook. No one's as mean as you.
Oh, you're welcome. So I'm stealing this question from Hannah Dunleavy because she asked this question to Sophie Willen. And I just think it's really great when it comes to talking to women who have done brilliant things. I want to know how you are about receiving compliments, because reviews for Back to Life season 2 are quite rightly excellent across the board.
I sort of go, thank you. So make a stupid voice and go, ugh. Then move on.
Sort of back away from
I was really happy about reading, because you don't receive, when you get a good review, you just read it quietly, and no one's looking at your face, so you can just go, oh, that's really nice, I'm so grateful. So yeah, I enjoy receiving good reviews. I like that. I don't like bad ones, they make me cry.
Do you read your reviews? Do you seek them out?
I do with Back to Life. I do. I never bother with anything else, but Back to Life, I just can't not, because I just can't not. It seems I'm desperate to sort of see how it's going down, and you know, see if people are getting the things that you've tried to get out of your head, really.
So just in case anyone has been living in a bin since 2019, because it has been tempting at many times, Back to Life is about Miri Mattison, who, after serving 18 years in prison for a crime she committed in her teens, finally returns to her small seaside hometown to, well, basically a rapturous welcome from absolutely everyone, right?
She's a huge hit. No, yeah, poor thing. Yeah, we were trying to sort of, you know, what would be the worst possible thing. So yeah, she comes home and it's really, really shit. And she's trying to start a life with this terrible thing hanging behind her, this awful past.
And despite the 2-year break from our tellies, Back to Life Series 2 picks up from where Series 1 left off.
Yeah, we wanted it to sort of all span, really, only a matter of weeks rather than anything else. It felt like there was a lot more to do in the immediate aftermath of coming out of prison. So yeah, it's pretty much straight away, a couple of weeks later.
What made you want to write about a recently released prisoner?
So many years ago, I had a conversation with Harry and Jack Williams and Sarah Hammond at Two Brothers, and they were very sweetly said, oh, look, if you've got any ideas. And I kept pitching awful ideas. And then I was living at home with my mum and dad, who were driving me crazy. And I think Amanda Knox kept being kind of photographed and sort of was on front of papers looking like, they kept choosing very sexualized pictures, mm-hmm. and calling her Foxy Noxy. And I was like, oh God, I mean, I don't know what she did yet, but why are we doing this to her? I was just sort of fascinated with how we vilify women and how we cannot handle the concept of a woman doing something wrong, I think, in a way that is slightly different with men. So that was something that was in my head. I was like, gosh, it's interesting how, you know, no matter what the truth is or what's happened, how we are portraying her is interesting. It's like a whole other thing happening. Mm-hmm. So those were the things. And so I pitched the show to Harry and Jack, and they said, yes, they liked the idea. And so then that, so actually I created Back to Life and then wrote the pilot, which we shot a little thing, we shot a little taster tape thing with Chris Sweeney to then get a commission for the series. And then when we got the commission, I was 8 months pregnant. So then I begged Laura Salon to come on and be co-writer, because I knew that we'd need another set of trustworthy and amazing eyes on it all.
Yeah.
So we then worked together from there, and that's how it all kind of happened.
And did you do any research into recently released prisoners? Did you speak to anyone who had just come out of prison?
Yeah, I spoke to women who had left, and one woman who was amazing and really interesting and had gone home to the small town where she'd done this thing, which I didn't ever find out what it was that she did. It was much more about the experience of coming home. We didn't even talk much about prison, as much as a few details, but it was more about what was it like, what was frustrating, how were you treated, and the main sort of thread. I mean, I know it's the same, to be fair, it's the same for men. You know, I spoke to men who left prison. It's not like they have an easy time. They really don't. Mm-hmm. I suppose with Mary, I was thinking about how difficult it is anyway as a woman in your 30s without a job or, you know, a partner, because there seems to be some kind of thing where people think you should have a partner, which of course you do what the hell you want, but how hard it would be to sort of start a life with no job, no anything. And then if we throw in this extra awful thing, which is what all these women were talking about, was like, you know, you think it's hard enough in your 30s, then chuck in the fact that you did something awful and you're in prison.
It feels like a really nice hook to be able to explore bigger picture stuff.
Exactly, that was the thing. It was just felt interesting. And also just to sort of make something really difficult for someone. Okay, so you live at home, you don't have a job, you don't have this, you don't have that. Oh, and by the way, you killed somebody. And start your life now.
Because series two does just like absolutely pick up the baton from series one. Did you already have it mapped out what was going to happen? Was that storyline already something that you'd thought about?
I knew that I wanted us to meet the parents of Lara. So yeah, I knew that was going to be, and I knew exactly how I wanted the whole season to end. But apart from that, the rest just kind of unfolded. I never map things out. Whenever we do, Laura always laughs, because then I'll just go off and start writing, and then I'll suddenly kill somebody that we had in the final episode. I'm like, I'm sorry, if you plan it, if I'm going to have to fuck it up on purpose, because I bought it's too boring knowing what's happening. I need to not know. I need to imagine I'm watching it, so I get really excited. So it's exciting.
And obviously, there will still be people out there who haven't watched series two yet, and so I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but I do have to ask you, why did you decide to ruin Ade Edmondson forever?
I know. I'm so sorry. He deserves it.
He's so chilling.
He's so scary. No, it's his fault. He wrote us a Twitter thing saying, you know, I love the show so much. And then just as we were writing, Mr. Boback, me and Laura were like, oh, you know, he'd be brilliant, wouldn't he? You're just never going to like him again.
What I found and what I absolutely love about Back to Life, and I think it's very rare in a TV series, it's a very kind series. It is packed with hope and love, and not redemption, but certainly forgiveness, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it is. I'm so bad at knowing what it's got in it, if that makes sense. But yeah, I think it becomes abundantly clear that that is a big part of what I care about. So, you know, I was like, you know, wanted it to, despite the darkness, to feel very hopeful, and to have at the centre of it, you have this character who is an optimist and has a good heart. And yeah, and I do believe in forgiveness, really. I mean, of course, sometimes you cannot forgive. Mm-hmm. That goes without saying. But fundamentally, as a society, we need to operate on that, on kindness and forgiveness as much as we can. And then there are some people, obviously, yeah, no. But, yeah, someone asked me that. They was like, so you would forgive anyone? I was like, no, of course not. I'm just saying that when someone's made a mistake and they've paid for it and they know and they're clearly a good person, like, come on. So yeah, so I think that is the show's heart, is hopefully beating strong.
Miri is definitely a big part of the heart alongside Billy, but we'll get to him in a second. And so I wondered, obviously you've written a lot of her now. What is your favourite thing about Miri?
I think her optimism, actually. Her, like, yep, she'll just kind of say yep. And that's quite fun for a character because it means they're always driving the story forward because they are a yes person. So like, you wouldn't be surprised if they suddenly end up in a crazy situation because you know they've just kind of gone, they're open-hearted and hopeful despite all the terrible things that have happened to her. I think that's what I like about her.
She's a real mix of naivety because obviously she went to prison at such a young age she hadn't finished forming, and optimism, and also like steeliness because she's been in prison for 18 years.
Yeah, that's what was fun about this series is that we showed a bit more of that, I think, a bit more of her kind of like, don't you fuck with me. And then you're like, oh, she might have won a few arm wrestles. That's surprising.
Yeah, she doesn't look the type, but
no. Well, I'm not the type. I'm glad we didn't have to show that.
Can we talk about Billy, played by Adil Akhtar? I think he is the romantic hero we all need.
Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, he's so gorgeous, isn't he? Yeah, we also really, really wanted to write, I was determined to write, the romantic relationship that was really innocent and just about friendship and love and not about sex. And, you know, not that I love sex, not to say that there's anything wrong with that, just that, you know, I wanted to see the central relationship just be like, if they just brush hands, then you're going, oh, you know,
it's a real,
and he's just
thriller.
A good, yeah, he's a good man. And he just really decides to take her on. And I think that is just really romantic, isn't it?
And you are a romantic, or certainly it comes across that you are a romantic, because also Caroline and Oscar, Miri's parents, there's a big rediscovering of a romance there that is really heartwarming, I think.
Yeah, I know, I'm a big old soppy arsehole, aren't I? Yeah, but yeah, their story is really about forgiveness. At the end of the first season, he says, I forgive you, and then the things she did, then, you know, it's their sort of journey is about what does forgiveness actually look like. It's all right to say it and to make up for a week, but then what's it like, you know, a month later? The betrayal is still there. So I thought, you know, we really wanted to, that became apparent when writing season two, that it was going to be about their relationship and really, really learning to forgive each other and find out who they are now within their marriage.
We talked about reviews up at the top. Have you had any response from prisoners?
Yes, actually, we've had a few tweets and things from, I mean, just sort of little moments where you think, oh God, thank God, where somebody says, you know, oh, thank you for telling another story and giving, you know, and shining a sort of sympathetic light on this story rather than on the other. So there's been a few messages that have been really lovely that have kind of, yeah, that made me and Laura really happy.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. And no really horrible ones. So that's good.
Are we going to see Miri again? Is she going to be back?
I don't know. I haven't been asked yet. So I'm just kind of, I mean, we have, I think season two does complete. Mm. I've been talking about things that we could, that we, you know, the next part of the story. For me, it would be a bit later, but we haven't been asked yet. So we'll see.
Watch this space. So as well as Back to Life, you can also regularly be seen on TV swearing at children.
I can. And at home.
I'd like to thank you for reinforcing my decision not to have children, because Breeders, in which you star alongside Martin Freeman, is, well, I mean, it's brutal, isn't it? It's pretty brutal.
It's a giant condom, isn't it? I don't think Simon Blackwell would like me to describe it like that, but it's, yeah, it is, isn't it? And also for me, my kids are really young and this is the next phase. So every time I'm like looking ahead going, oh my God, is this going to happen? Oh shit, what have I done?
Do you think you'll ever let your kids watch it?
Maybe. I mean, I can't imagine them ever being old enough to watch it. Hopefully they'll get there. 3 and 6 right now, so I don't know. Yeah.
Is there more Breeders in the bag or happening?
I'm doing one more. Yeah, I'm doing one more season. Well, there's one more that I know of.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm very excited to be getting back to that after a nice break.
And what else are you up to?
Well, I've just been doing all the press for Back to Life, so, and I've only just stopped, really. So I'm just going to hang out. I've got lots of ideas for new shows, but I also just need to be around and just hanging out and cooking too much fun food and eating crisps.
Get that big bowl of crisps out. That sounds amazing.
I literally do that every night, though, which is really bad. Do you do it every night?
I'm a big crisp fan.
I think I do a mixed bowl every night. Yeah.
I don't believe in family bags. It says it on the packet, but... it's not a thing.
No, I don't. But I do it all the time. And I just, I need to maybe not have crisps 3 nights a week, but I haven't done that yet.
Crisps are like what other people do with wine. You're like, I need like 3 dry nights a week.
Yeah, no, but I do them together, so it's all a disaster. It's always like, whenever I open the wine, my daughters go, are they going to be crisps? It's like my starter for every meal.
Well, I mean, I think you're doing life brilliantly, and thank you so much for bringing us such a wonderful series and for chatting to me.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm joined by Catherine Cranfield, writer and director of Flushed, which opens tomorrow at the Park Theatre in Finsbury Park. Thank you for joining me, Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Is this your first post-pandemic project?
Yes. Yes, it is.
That's a smiley face. Tell me how that feels to be out and working again.
It feels absolutely amazing. The show was actually programmed originally to be performed in June 2020. So it's been quite the delay and quite the sort of, oh, will it happen? Won't it happen? It's all a bit mad that it's finally here. And you kind of feel like, oh, it's in the future, it's in the future, it's in the future, because it's such a question mark.
Yeah.
But now it's here. It's come around really, really fast, which I guess is always the way. But yeah, it's just so nice to be back in the theatre and back doing what we love to do, really.
So, Flushed, it's about two sisters, and it's also about premature ovarian insufficiency, which I'll admit, I didn't actually know that much about until I did some research for this interview. So I wondered if we could start, and by we, I mean you, by giving an explanation for those listeners who also are not in the know as to what POI is.
POI is a condition, basically, where your ovaries stop producing eggs years, sometimes decades before they should. And they also stop producing the hormones estrogen and progesterone, which have super vital roles in overall women's health and general well-being. It affects about 1% of under 40-year-olds. And it's a condition which, to be honest, before I started on this project, I didn't really know that much about. And I've been struck by doing this project. This is the 5th year now, I think. We're going to the 5th year of doing the show. And I've had audiences over that 5-year span, many, many audience members coming up to me saying, I didn't know that was a thing. I hadn't heard of that before. Mm. So it's definitely not something which is talked about or given any airtime, really. So that's the driving motivator for the project, really. When I first started writing the, and I didn't know specifically what I wanted to look at within the play. The whole play is set in toilets in various different bathrooms. And it started basically as a love letter to all of those conversations that I've had on, you know, drunken nights out, the weird and wonderful world that is the ladies' room, which I feel like the actual function of the room is the least important purpose. I feel like it's just so many other things. All of those conversations and all of those people I've met. So that's kind of where it started. And I had all these sort of bathroom chats burbling about in my head. And I had these two sisters, these two characters sort of bopping around in my head, and I was sort of, well, what is this? I realised, well, a bathroom, yes, it's a very fun and entertaining setting, but it's a very intimate setting. And so is this play a good vehicle for looking at women's health and perhaps a vehicle for me to understand a bit more about my own body? And so, yes, yeah, so I sort of looking up various women's health conditions, and when I came across POI, I hadn't really heard of it before. And that's why I was like, oh, okay, this should be talked about. Like, I didn't know this was a thing. So I contacted Daisy Network back in 2017. And yeah, we've been working together ever since, really.
Daisy Network, I should clarify, is the charity that deals with women with POI in the UK, isn't it?
Yeah, so yeah, the only charity that's their sort of specific goal is to offer support to those experiencing POI, yeah. They're incredible. They're run entirely by volunteers. They are a support system, really, and it's been a privilege working with them over the years. We actually did the show once at Chelsea and Westminster Hospital as part of They have Daisy Day, which is like an annual gathering, I guess, basically. And everyone gets together and there's cups of tea and there's speakers and there's just a chance for people to meet each other and to talk. And because I think the thing which has struck me the most, and I guess the main motivator, is it can be a very isolating diagnosis. I think, you know, when things aren't talked about and shown in the media, and also for 90% actually of people diagnosed with the condition, they are diagnosed with spontaneous POI, which means there's no cause. So they don't have anything to sort of, you know, to grasp onto in that sense either. So it can be a very sort of isolating and confusing condition. So I think that's why Daisy bringing people together is so amazing.
Because actually, you stated those figures, but when it happens to younger women, it becomes increasingly rare. 1 in 1,000 yeah. women under 30 and 1 in 10,000 women under 20. So really isolating, I would say. I presume when you were writing this, you were able to talk about case study things with the Daisy Network to look at the kind of issues that women with POI face. So I wonder if you could give a couple of ideas. I'm guessing fertility is a big one.
So the Daisy Network actually put me in contact with many, many women who've been incredibly generous and sat down with me and shared their story with me. And obviously everybody's journey is unique, but I think definitely the feelings of sort of confusion and isolation were the main things which seemed to be quite a common occurrence. But yeah, I think having the opportunity to meet with people and get their experience firsthand, really, I've really tried to work that into the play. Particularly talking about fertility, I should also mention, so I've done a lot of work with Daisy, but I've also worked very closely with Fertility Fest. In 2019, we did Flushed Out the Barbican as part of Fertility Fest. It was like a whole big arts festival, basically bringing art and science together and looking at how many ways there are to make a family.
As a whole, from what you've seen, how seriously do you think women's healthcare does get taken by the medical profession, and how much more needs to be done?
A lot more needs to be done. Having, like I said, having sat down with those women and talked to them about their diagnosis, a common theme seems to be being passed around a lot. Mm. And there's a line in the show where she says, you get passed around like some fucking hot potato until finally someone sits you down and says they're sorry. I think the research isn't there. And I don't know, it just must be the most incredibly frustrating thing to not have some kind of answer for why something's happened. And it doesn't get treated as seriously. And also perhaps because it's not like a life or death situation. Mm. You know, I use that, you know, inverted commas, but it can have serious effects on your mental health as a condition. Physically, the discomfort that these women go through, the youngest woman that I've met, she's 15, you know, she's a child herself, and she's being sat down and bounced around and told that she can't have children and that all of these things are going on inside her body, and she's 15. Like, how can it not be taken as seriously? I don't know, so that feels baffling to me.
It baffles me every time people come on and tell us about, you know, endometriosis, for example, which is way more common, and yet they've still struggled for years and years and years to get anybody to take them seriously.
Premature ovarian insufficiency as well, until very recently, was called premature ovarian failure as well.
Oh, Christ.
Which really, yeah. I mean, that's just such a loaded word.
Yeah.
It just says it all, really.
No, I agree. So let's talk about Flushed, because I know you're keen that people know that this is upbeat, although it's about a serious subject matter, but it is an upbeat play. So what can people expect if they come to Flushed?
When they come to Flushed, they can expect to see 2 toilets. That's the set. You walk in, bam, there's 2 toilets right in front of you. A lot of laughs, 2 sisters. It looks at womanhood, sisterhood, motherhood and toilets, I think is my sort of my line, because it really does. It's 2 sisters supporting each other, having a laugh. Very relatable. If you've ever had those drunken chats in the loos, you know, if you've ever met people out in the loos, you will relate. But also Flushes for everyone, because if you haven't had those experiences, then come and see why women always go nip off to the loo in pairs, because, and have those chats, and come and see the relationship between these two sisters, because it's a really caring, sensitive, fun relationship. And they're also just navigating their 20s. What is that? The highs and lows.
Yeah.
Trying to work it out.
I genuinely wonder what the last 18 months will do to people at that developmental stage. When I think about women that basically went inside at 20 and came out now nearly 22, that sort of, yeah, what that lost time and that lost shared experience that they used to have. I mean, I know, yeah, I know there is online community, but there's nothing like you say, just being drunk in a pub toilet with your friend.
Yeah, it's not the same, you know. My most horrific fuck-ups were in 20 to 23, you know? And, like, yeah, how are you going to have that on Zoom? It's not really the same. We're getting there. We're getting there, I feel, hopefully.
We are.
We're moving in the right direction.
So, Flushed, at the Park Theatre from the 12th of October to the 6th of November. Do you have any other things in the works after that?
Oh, gosh, do I? So I run a company with me and my partner, Ellis Shotton, who's also a writer. Shout out to Ellis. We are a queer-led collective who are always looking to put new work on. So I think the best way to answer that would be to say, please get in touch. Like, if you have an idea, please get in touch with us.
Right.
Because we're always looking to collaborate with new people. But in terms of, like, specific... Hannah, my heart and soul has been going into this show.
Of course it has. I always feel like such a dick when I ask that question, especially when you open like in 4 days from when we're talking.
My brain. This is quite exciting. I am actually, but this is probably not for the podcast. I don't know if this is podcast worthy, but I've recently got onto the Soho Theatre Drag Lab course. So I'm playing around doing some drag, like putting together a drag act, which is quite fun, but... It's a completely different vibe to Flushed.
Okay, well, tell me where people can find out more.
People can find out more from our Twitter. We are at Theatre Unlocked and at Grace Dixon Productions as well, who is our co-producer, who's phenomenal. Very lucky to be working with her. And on Park Theatre's website as well.
Catherine, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such fun.
You play ball like a girl!
Go on, do one, kid. Jenny off the blocks.
Welcome to Jenny off the blocks, that time of the week where we rise up the velodrome wall in pursuit of a journey rider as we discuss all things women's sport. I'm talking, of course, about Katie Archibald, who took home basically all the gold medals at the European Track Cycling Championships last week in her first competition since the Tokyo Olympics, where she took home a gold and a silver. Archibald claimed victory in the Omnium, Scratch and the Madison alongside Nia Evans. With those 3 golds under her belt and 17 in total, she surpasses Laura Kenny's 15 European titles, making her the most successful rider in the event's history. So congratulations to her and, of course, to Nia. It's not bad for a 27-year-old, right? Let's have a look now at the findings of a new report by the Youth Sport Trust, which have been published this week. And when I say new, the report is new, but to my mind, the findings are anything but. So the headline finding here is... it's depressing as fuck, to be honest. And that is that a third of girls in England are prevented from enjoying sport by a mixture of things including low confidence, being watched by other people, and the biggest reason? Periods. 37% of the girls surveyed said that periods had stopped them from being active in the last school year, compared to 27% from the previous survey covering 2018 to 19. Of the 27,000 school-age girls surveyed, 33% said they weren't confident to get active, and 33% also said that they found other people watching them put them off. Things like skimpy PE kits left girls feeling exposed, they said. And it's true. Let's think about that particular point for a minute. You know, in my day, in my first year of secondary school, girls wore actual pants under skirts to run around in. And if you forgot your skirt, you were in your pants. In my second year, the system changed and instead we were allowed to wear the much more progressive cycling shorts. But, you know, it's still a skin-tight garment. I'd like to think that things have come on a bit since then, but... look at the headlines over the summer. Even elite-level female athletes clearly feel exposed in what they're told to wear. It's just not the same with boys and with men. But this is all part of the same picture, and it's an old picture. What is the common theme here? I think it's shame. We continue to teach girls to feel shame about their bodies, shame of their bodily functions, shame of what their bodies look like, shame at how they perform. And it's frightening, because if we instill that shame in them so early on, that is potentially going to have lifelong ramifications. But also, we're not empowering them to feel good about their bodies or curious about what they can do with them. And that is stifling their potential. And I know I am preaching to the choir here, because I don't think you'd be listening to this if you didn't agree with me. But these are not new issues, and yet all of these figures had risen, at least by a few percent, since the last survey. So we're seeing huge progression in women's sport, we're told, at least, in terms of visibility and accessibility. Why are we not progressing here? Why have these attitudes not changed? I mean, it's kind of a stupid question, because those attitudes have not changed across the board. Like, society is, you know, it's a big nut to crack, isn't it? But it's very alarming. Anyway, let's end on a high. The old shit sandwich, as ever. In rugby league, congratulations to St Helens, who ran in a whopping 6 tries to win the Women's Super League Grand Final 28-0 over Leeds Rhinos, thus securing an historic treble. And they'd already won the Challenge Cup and the League Leaders' Shield this season. With that third victory, they go one better than the men's team, who won the double this year. And they did it live on Sky Sports, and with a record crowd of 4,235 people at the match. Speaking after the match, Captain Jodie Cunningham put the successes down to a hard graft during the off-season and the shit show of a cancelled league in 2020, and she added that she hoped the win could inspire young girls watching. She said, "We do it because we love it. Days like today, to be part of this, when I started playing, I never dreamed of this." So that's a nice place to end. Well done to them. Right, that's all from me this week. I'll be back next time with more women's sport.
Welcome to Rated or Dated. Hannah, what film that we watched this week made it abundantly clear that coal mining, it's not for me?
Oh, shit, yeah. This week we watched 1976's Harlan County, USA, the first full-length documentary by producer and director Barbara Koppel and her mostly female team. It tells the story of a long and bloody miners' strike in rural Kentucky as miners and their families, so very much and their families, faced down one of America's largest utility firms, the Duke Power Company, in a bid to improve safety, working conditions and pay. So let's start by asking, have either of you seen it before? Have either of you even heard of it before?
No and no.
No and yes, because when I started watching Justified, I got a little bit curious about Harlan County and whether it was an actual place, which it is, and this documentary popped up on my radar, and then you and I have chatted about it as well.
Yeah,
I mean, I'd heard of it because you've mentioned it before, Hannah, but apart from that, no, I haven't.
I had heard of it before because I love a documentary, but you forget that pre-streaming days, it was actually unbelievably difficult to watch over
here.
Yeah,
of course.
I eventually, after watching the first series of Justified, probably 10 years ago, I bought an American DVD of it because I had a laptop that would play multi-region. But I no longer have that laptop, so I have a DVD that won't play in anything. And I no longer even have a DVD player, so there you go. So I hadn't seen it for about 10 years. As I mentioned last week, Harlan County, USA is often called one of the greatest documentaries ever made. And interestingly, it was released in cinemas just a few months after one of its rivals in the best ever category, Grey Gardens. And I bring that up not only because it demonstrates how capricious it is to try to choose a best anything, but also because Koppel had worked with the Maisel brothers in the past, and because the two films use a similar narrative style, eschewing a voiceover and allowing its subjects to tell the story in their own words.
Yeah.
And fuck me, is that effective? And fuck me, what a story it is. Because while it's the 1970s in the rest of America, in some parts of Kentucky, it's still the 1930s.
Isn't it just?
Miners and their families live in poverty, often in houses without running water, and many battling black lung. And for many of them, this is merely an extension of the decade-long battle in the 1930s, in which miners sought to unionise, and which led to the area gaining the nickname Bloody Harlan. Not least because those men were the fathers and grandfathers of the miners in this documentary. And Koppel underpins this with a soundtrack of local folk tunes, all of which are infused with the history of the region. Like the Maisels in Grey Gardens, you can often hear Koppel behind the camera asking questions. And it's a striking, no pun intended, reminder that she is a woman in her 20s and herself in a lot of danger. A point that's driven home when Koppel and a cameraman are attacked and beaten at the side of the road during a horrible few minutes that takes place almost entirely in the dark and is soundtracked by nearby screaming and gunfire. Koppel's ability to form close relationships with the miners and their family gives her almost unprecedented access to the heart of the community, but it also leaves her open to accusations of impartiality. And to be fair, she's not impartial. In her defence, I'm not sure I'd be much inclined to choose to chat to a company who hired armed thugs to terrorise their striking miners and their families and shot into their homes where their children were sleeping.
Bloody hell.
A Criterion Collection essay by Paul Arthur in 2006 highlights some of the other criticisms of the film of the time. Quote, oddly, in its time, Harlan County, USA was repudiated by elements of the cultural left, including some feminists. It centred a debate involving the political efficacy of documentary realism and the probity of commercial distribution. If a supposedly progressive film reached a popular audience, was that evidence of a compromised political perspective? Could adherence to standard codes of dramatic closure or visual transparency be understood as reaffirming aspects of bourgeois ideology? To which I'd say, it never ceases to amaze me how much some elements of the left focus on hypothetical ideals rather than actual people, and continue to do so. Most critics, however, do agree and still agree that Harlan County, USA was a powerful, important and stirring film. It has a fabled 100% on Rotten Tomatoes and won the 1976 Oscar for Best Documentary. Enough said. Hey, well, maybe not. Some miners have also said that this fight would not have been won were it not for the presence of Koppel and her crew. And there's all sorts of conversations we could have about the problems of documenting something without changing the outcome, even if you think that it is a positive change. But I wanted to start by asking you two a question. Do you think the film, and I suppose then the outcome, would have been the same if Koppel had been a man?
It's an interesting question, and I think one of the reasons you're asking it is because there is an enormous that I'm making the word enormous bigger focus on the women here, on the wives. And like with our miners' strike in the 1980s, the power of those women, the solidarity of those women, the get shit doneness of those women is integral to pushing the cause forward. The men are fighting as hard as they can fight as well, but it's the women that seem to be the backbone. Mm. And I think maybe a male documentary maker would not have put the focus on them in the same way.
I wonder as well whether the men would have reacted differently to a male documentary maker rather than a woman. I think they would have seen her as more intrinsically pliable, and they're not saying she was, but therefore on their side more, they would have been less suspicious of her, I think.
Yeah, I think you're both right. Obviously, she has put a massive focus on the women, and possibly she wouldn't have gained their trust in the same way had she been a man. She possibly, as Hannah said, wouldn't have been able to form the same kind of relationships. Perhaps she was seen as less threatening, etc., etc.
She was certainly seen as more intimidatable. And she sure as fuck wasn't. I mean, her first meeting with Basil Collins, who's like the head strike breaker, who carries a gun in his pocket at all times.
Is this when he's asking her for her ID?
For a press pass, yeah. And she basically brushes him off and says afterwards that everyone says to her, do you realise who that was? She didn't know who she was talking to. Uh-huh. And that if she had known who she was talking to. But he clearly thought that she would be a pushover, and she wasn't. So I think her being a woman put everybody a little bit on a back foot, but in a good way on a back foot, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, and I agree with you.
Did you like it, to start with? Like's an odd word with something like this, but did you enjoy it? Do you see the value in it?
It's exactly what I was going to respond with. Like's a very interesting word in this case, and in cases like this. It made me furious. It's so fury-making. And although it is very clearly set in the past, and obviously the film looks old because it was filmed in the 1970s and it's those handheld cameras, but they're fucking massive, aren't they? They're like lugging these dinosaurs around with them. But it still feels really timely. There's a them and us aspect here of them, which is those with the power and the money, do not give a shit about the us, which is the people who are struggling to make ends meet, who think they've had an all right deal and just want something better, and then are finding out that they've had the worst deal ever and they're being treated like shit. So it also feels sadly like something incredibly timely that will always be timely as long as there is that division in class and in labour and in who owns the wealth. It's excellent. I can understand why it's so highly rated. It's gripping. It had more singing in it than I was expecting, I'll be honest with you there. Sort of like a really depressing pride. But shit me, even when they'd won various battles, it didn't feel like they were ever going to win the war. And again, like in this country, the miners haven't won that war.
To me now, there's an added value in this, in that what it was at the time was a piece of politics and what it is now is a piece of social history. In that it has...
I can't see why that would appeal to you.
Like, say, for example, when the miner is in New York protesting and he talks to the black cop. That is like a time capsule. I mean, this is in the, unsurprisingly, in the Library of Congress. And that conversation alone, I think, justifies it being there. In the sense that it is like two parts of America meeting. And meeting at slightly different angles than you would have expected them to meet 100 years previously and into the future, if that makes sense.
That's the bit I was referring to when I said they sort of think they've got an all right deal and then they discover they've not, because the cop is just like, what do you make an hour? And he's like, oh, you know, it's this, and he's like, I make way more than that. What holiday do you get? What sick pay do you get? And they're like, nothing. And you can see it hitting home to him.
Yeah.
It's happening right there. And I know obviously that is the point of a documentary, but you can see this realisation of just how badly they have been treated registering.
Yeah. Jen, were you a fan?
I mean, I obviously see the value in it. And I think what Mickey says is right, that like the kind of things that they're talking about, the issues are timeless, really. Those things are always going to exist. There's always going to be corruption. There's always going to be shitty people mistreating people at the bottom. There's always, you know, that those kind of things are always going to happen, unfortunately, in a capitalist society. So yeah, absolutely see the value in it. Like, again, is not really a word that I would use. I found it a little bit, and again, I feel like I say this a lot, and it's not really fair because this is me. It's not the actual documentary, but I felt like I needed to be spoon-fed a little bit more. Like I needed the narrative or the narration or whatever to be a little bit more like, I don't know, like put together, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
There was an aspect of tuning in. Those accents and the age of the film, I had to sort of tune my ear in. And I actually thought, actually, I'm really glad I've watched Justified first, because I tune into that accent really quickly. That Harlan County accent made sense to me a lot quicker than I thought someone else coming at it who I'd never seen anything like that before. I actually really like that she doesn't spoon feed you.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, like I said, it's me. I'm a basic bitch. But like, I think it is probably a lot to do with like, you know, my frame of mind or whatever, or like my ability to concentrate on things or something like that. I don't think it's probably really a valid criticism. It's just like I guess just a preference more than anything else.
I'm going to join you in basic bitchdom here, I think. And that is to say that even though I have read lots of stuff about the miners and the miners' strike, and we talked about the miners' strike in our documentary about Thatcher, and I spoke to loads of women who were involved in the miners' strike, I'm not like coming to this as a complete beginner, but fuck me, those opening scenes drove home to me how terrifying that job is.
Oh, bloody hell, yeah.
And I kind of knew it's really dangerous, it's really horrible, it's really isolating, it's really dark, and that's why they are such an incredible community, because they go through this hell together every day. But, like, going down with the camera with them, just, I felt claustrophobic from the comfort of my own sofa.
Yeah, there is a clash here in that there are men fighting for the right to do a job that most of us wouldn't do. And that sort of adds to the desperation of it. And I think what I find really poignant about it now, in that, you know, remember when I said there should be a new level grated, and I meant grated, meaning it really got on my tits. I feel like there should be grated, greated, because there's a poignancy in the fact that they are, and they consistently say, fighting for them, but for also for their children. And again, it's like the miners here. In the long term, that fight was lost.
Yeah.
there's a point in which they're all, the women are meeting and they're having an argument about people's husbands. And one of them says, I don't care about any of this. Whoever wants my husband can take him. I'm worried about my boys.
Yep.
And it's funny, but it's really sad because I don't know what happened to her children. I don't know where they work now because the problem with coal miners only stopped because we stopped mining coal rather than because anybody ever started treating them in any way better.
Definitely. And obviously you say at the top that Koppel isn't necessarily impartial. She does try to speak to the company men, and they are very much company men. And each and every single one of them can get in the fucking sea, man. They're just like, they're horrific. When the guy's saying about, oh, black lung, yeah. But, you know, even when there's coal dust in the lungs, it doesn't necessarily mean that's the cause. And you're like, oh, my goodness, the absolute brass balls of this guy to be stood there saying that. And then you go, oh, it's only like sort of this era when they went, oh, maybe cigarettes aren't good for people. So they're playing on people's ignorance of how medicine works, about how the body works, how health works, to just keep rolling in that lovely cash. It's just, oh, it's so fury-making.
And the violence, there was a lot of violence in the miners' strike in this country, and that's probably where people's minds are going. But beyond that, it was violent on a level that I can't quite comprehend. I mean, during this film, there's an election for the United Mine Workers of America, and one of the candidates and his wife and daughter are murdered. It's staggering the amount of violence in this. Also, somebody shot on the picket line, a young man shot and killed on the picket line. And those scenes are horrible. His funeral.
They are. And I think it's really key. You mentioned at the top that this documentary might well have been the thing that pushed through the changes in the contract that they are fighting for. But that is the other thing that gets a lot of credit for pushing through those, that change in the contract, is if they hadn't murdered one of the miners, then the miners wouldn't have won that particular fight. Yeah. It'd have just kept going.
To be clear, I didn't say that she helped push through the contract. They said that her making the film changed the outcome, was what he said. By that I mean her standing on the picket line filming, and apparently she used to film whether she had film in a camera or not, reduce the chances of people doing terrible things because they would be caught on camera doing them.
Oh, that makes lots of sense.
So that her being there changed the tone of it slightly, made it less violent, if you can believe that. Because like I say, it is unbelievably violent in parts. So, coal is dead. Life expectancy in Harlan County is around 7 years below the national average for men and women. It ranks in the highest 10% of all United States counties in the prevalence of poverty amongst its residents. By 2018, more than half of the county's income came from transfers from the federal government. So that means Social Security, Medicare and food stamps. Also in 2016, a national election. Voting turnout was 30%. And among those that did vote, 84% went for Trump. Having watched this film, do you understand that decision any better?
I guess it's the same kind of thing everywhere, isn't it? Why are people here voting for the Conservatives in like working class areas? Yes, I think I do.
I think when a group of people is disenfranchised and they go, well, the same old isn't helping me. You either don't vote at all and you said turnout was 30%, or you vote for the opposite of what you've always voted for in the fucking, like, just scant hope that something
shifts. Or you vote for that, you articulated that better than me, Mickey, or you vote for the people who they're promising you something different and they're criticising the people that you perceive to be the ones that took that shit away from you or made your life worse. So I think it does make sense.
Trump did specifically go after miners, I mean, quite heavily in Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania obviously is a swing state. I think unionism was what the left was in these places.
Yeah.
And when you remove the union, through what method is the left speaking to these areas? It's lost its contact with those people.
Absolutely. It's why it's called Labour, right? It's the Labour Party. It's the party for labourers. It itself is some sort of great big union of all labourers of all different professions. And when the unions go, what do you stand for?
So before I ask the last question, I'd just like to make the statement that I think Harlan County, USA was probably not the best choice of title. I'd have gone for They Can't Shoot the Union Out of Me, personally. A line spoken by one of the women in it, Lois, who is the woman who pulls the gun out of her top. There's a lovely interview with Barbara Koppel on a site called The Silent Projectionist, in which she tells a story about asking Lois whether it's sensible to have a gun down your top. And she said, if it goes off and I lose a bit of titty, I've got a lot to spare. Okay, final question. Rated or dated? Mick.
Rated. Yeah.
Jen.
I mean, there's too many fucking banjos for my liking, but if you take that aside, I think it would be fair to say, on balance, it's rated.
Yeah, absolutely rated. Well, what's coming up next week?
We've got a surprise next week, Hannah, so we'll tweet it out or chuck it in the mail out, okay, or something.
I like the way we've dressed that up. A surprise.
Always
rather than an administration error.
Mate, that's why I sit at a computer instead of haul my ass down a coal pit.
Standard issue for all women.